So as we are getting close to the end of the semester, this is class 21. We have 26 classes. So just a few more left. The last class, I'm going to just run a review session. So it's really till class 25. So how many classes? Five, four. And the topics will get more and more complicated, involved, etc. We've done some stuff like simultaneous contract signing. That was pretty heavyweight protocol there. So okay, let me write this down. And I need some notes because this gets a little complex. Zero knowledge proofs, I forgot the D here, is kind of more of a, you know, fancy phrase than what it is really. Zero knowledge proofs have been touted to be the, you know, it can be used for everything, it just is wonderful. There has been quite a lot of hype about this, pretty much like blockchain, it'll solve world's problems and hunger and everything. No, it won't. But it's a pretty interesting concept. Now, it starts with proof. Now, you want to prove something. If you want to prove something, take a simple case. The angles of a triangle sum up to 180 degrees. How do you prove that? You draw some constructions and show that. And comes from Euclidean days, way, way back. But when you prove that, you are writing a proof. It's written. So you write this proof. How do you know it's correct? You could be just making up some proof. So as a prover, you write the proof and somebody verifies it. That look, okay, just from this writing, I can see how you came to this conclusion and it's correct. That is, you have proved that it's 180 degrees when you sum them. Now, but in the process, you have disclosed what are you trying to prove and the proof itself. Zero knowledge proofs say that you will prove something, the verifier will agree that you've proven it, but you have not disclosed anything about what is it that you're trying to prove. Okay? So, how can you do that? Well, there are methods to do that. We'll see. That you'll disclose something, like, I know this thing, but the information that you're giving out has no information about how, why or how or... That's the idea. But the example that is chosen to show this, which appears in every place where they talk about zero knowledge proofs, is, and I don't particularly care about this, but it says there is a cave, and this cave, let's say, is underground. There is a hole that you can go into, and inside the cave there is a roundabout passage and there's a door over here. And we have Peggy, who's the prover. And Victor, who's the verifier. So Peggy wants to prove that she can go through the door. Magic. And Victor has to verify that she can go through the door. And of course, if they both go down there and she passes through it, then Victor will get to know how she does that. So she's not going to show how she does that. So the story goes that Peggy goes and disappears into the cave. And Victor then comes, so this is Peggy. Victor then comes in and stands here and tells Peggy to come out of the cave from this side or this side. So he says left or right, and she comes out that way. So let's say Peggy went to the left and Victor said come out from the left. Obviously she can do that. So that doesn't prove anything. But if Victor says come out through the right, then it's obviously, but he didn't see which way Peggy went in. So the answer is just repeat it. Do it 100 times. And even if you don't know which way she went in, she cannot be coming out of some side that you choose unless if she knows how to go through the door. It's not a great story, but whatever. That's the idea. Okay? I can find flaws, but we are not going in there. So, these zero knowledge proofs are called interactive proof systems. There is a version which is non-interactive, but we'll look at it. And the properties are completeness, soundness, and of course you can do this for reasons of authentication. No, I'm just gonna, there's a whole bunch of problems that can be proven. I'm going to take a more sizable example, which will be graph isomorphism. So let's just to take a look at these two, authentication and graph isomorphism. Authentication says you prove that you know something, like your password, without disclosing your password. Now there is an obvious way to do it. How can you prove that you know a secret without anybody knowing that secret or you disclosing that secret? Obviously it doesn't work with passwords because you have to give the password to the other person and you've disclosed. Challenge response. Challenge response on symmetric keys, challenge response on symmetric keys, of course, both parties know that. Challenge response on public keys, where you know the private key, the other party doesn't, and you prove that you know your private key. However, that's not an interactive proof system with the zero knowledge kind of multiple tries, etc., so it doesn't fall under zero knowledge proofs. There are zero-knowledge authentication methods, but you know, in practicality, why do I want to go into something that takes hundreds of attempts when I can just use public keys? Okay? So practical applications of zero-knowledge I have not seen, but it's touted as something that can be used for fantastic purposes. Not really, but it's interesting. So we'll talk about, later I'll talk about authentication. Now let's talk about graph isomorphism, which is an NP-complete problem. So is satisfiability, so is traveling salesman, and all of these can be done with zero-knowledge proofs. So what is graph isomorphism? And why is it difficult? graph, you know what a graph is, but what's like this graph and this graph, is it the same graph? Yes, it's the same graph. There's no difference between this and that. I've labeled these vertices, but if I change the label of PQRS to BADC, then you'll see that D is connected to A, which is BB. No, R and S will be the same. R is C, S is D. Okay? Now, this is obvious. It's not hard at all. By just looking at it, we know. But it turns out that moment you have these graphs that are rather large, even if you draw it, humans can't see the correlation if they are. They look very different if you draw it completely randomly, differently, and you can't really see the correlations, even if they are completely the same graph drawn differently. And worse is that computers don't draw graphs. They use an adjacency matrix. And so the adjacency, two adjacency matrices, it becomes, you pretty much, there are optimization tricks, but the brute force method is that you try all possible renumbering of the graph. You'll get an exponential number, and then see if they are the same. The adjacency matrices will become identical if you can relabel the graph in one particular way. Also, given a graph, it's very easy to create more graphs that are identical to it. So if I give a graph consisting of A, B, C, D, I can relabel the edge A to X, B to Y, or I can relabel the edge A to Y, B to X, whatever. There are so many different ways of relabeling them. And then for each relabeling, the matrix, which is in a particular order, will become different. But we know, since I know how it was relabeled, I can put it back. Okay, this is all silliness. But given two graphs whose things you have checked, that they have the same number of vertices, same number of edges, there is in degree of three, a certain number, and the other one has these things, they're all identical. All the parameters are identical, doesn't mean they're isomorphic. Isomorphic means they are exactly the same graph, and now that you have two graphs that maybe are isomorphic, the way to prove these two graphs are isomorphic is to say this edge in one graph is the same as this edge in the other. So you've got to show a mapping. So now Peggy has two graphs. G1 and G2. G1 is represented by a matrix Okay, let's take this example. I didn't put in the zeros and ones. There are zeros and ones. There are equal number of vertices. The number of one means there's a line from one in C to A will mean C and A are connected. This is not directional, but you can do directional also. If these two matrices are not the same, that does not mean they are not isomorphic. They could be isomorphic. Peggy's claim is now Peggy can show that G1 is equal to G2 if she shows the edge-to-edge correlation between G1 and G2. So that's the secret. She's not going to tell you. She's just claiming that these two are identical. But she's not willing to show the transformation between the two. So now she has to convince Victor that she knows that these two are identical. If they were not identical, Peggy should not be able to prove it. If they're identical, Peggy will be able to prove it using a zero-knowledge proof technique where Victor will not learn how these two are, which vertex here corresponds to which vertex there. Does that make sense? This is what I'm trying to do. Come up with a method by which Peggy can prove these two are isomorphic, if they are isomorphic, without disclosing the mapping from G1 to G2. How would you do that? And once you disclose the mapping, let's say A is the same as R, B is the same as Q, you just rearrange this matrix to go ABCD and ABCD, and then you'll see that the both will become exactly the same matrix, and that's the proof that it's isomorphic. Anything that's not clear, other than I didn't tell you what the algorithm is.
So you said that to prove it, they will need to do a lot of other proofs?
Yes.
So maybe the verifier can give Peggy a lot of other graphs? A
lot of other graphs, but Peggy will not be able to prove anything on these graphs. Okay?
She cannot solve that problem.
No. Because solving graphites, Peggy's not claiming, given two graphs, I can prove they're isomorphic if they are, because that's an NP-complete problem. It'll take her billions of years to do. However, she's claiming these two graphs I know are isomorphic. And of course, there's an easy proof to this, but I will not disclose that proof. I will convince you that I know the proof, which is the correlation of the edges from G1 to G2, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. So practically, there is no reason to do this, but we're trying to see, can I prove something without disclosing the proof? So Peggy first shows the graphs. The graphs are not secret. The correlation is secret. Okay? So Peggy gives Victor the two graphs. Victor checks and sees they look identical, but it's not clear that they are identical. So, and Peggy is claiming that they are. That's the setup. Now, can Peggy cheat here? Peggy creates a graph, G prime, that looks identical to these two. They look identical. Everything looks identical. But she's supposed to take G1 or G2 and relabel the edges to create G prime. Reorder the edges, essentially. So she can follow rules and do that. Victor won't know anything. Or she can just create G prime at random, then she will get stuck. Because Victor is going to ask her to prove the isomorphism between this G prime . So Peggy knows that the moment she provides G prime, Victor is going to say, show me the isomorphism between G prime and G1, or G prime and G2. And so if Peggy did not create it out of G1 or G2, she would obviously not be able to do this. But if Peggy created it from G1, and Victor wants the correlation from G prime to G2, she can do this one. She can obviously do this one because she created the graph G prime. She can do this one if she knows how to transform G prime to G1, she knows. And G1 to G2, if she knows, she'll be able to get G2. Is this a little confusing? Maybe not. There are two graphs. It's very easy to create a third graph which is isomorphic to one of them. You just relabel. So Peggy makes a graph from G1 which is isomorphic to G1. Now, if G1 and G2 are isomorphic, this G prime will be isomorphic to G2 also. If you know the mapping from G1 to G2 and you created G prime from G1, you should be able to put the two together and show a mapping from G prime to G2. Fine? So if Peggy knows the mappings from G1 to G2, she can answer both these questions. If she answers both the questions, then what happens? You know the complete mapping, so Victor will know how to go from G1 to G2, which is the secret Peggy won't disclose. So Peggy is willing to answer one of these questions. And there's a 50% chance . Why? Peggy creates it from G1. Victor asks for mapping to G1. Peggy is like, obvious. Suppose Peggy does not know how G1 transforms to G2. She creates a graph from G1. If Victor asks for the mapping to G1, obviously she knows, even though she does not know how to prove the result. So 50% of the time she can get away by just lying. So this is not very authoritarian that she actually knows the mapping of G1 to G2. But if you repeat it, so half the time she'll succeed in the first attempt. 1/4 of the time she'll succeed in the second attempt. Second time what happens is you cannot use G prime again. Because if you use it again, Victor will immediately say, show me the other one and get your secret out. So Victor presents a challenge, 0 or 1. 0 means show me G prime prime to G1. 1 means show me zero, G prime prime to G2. And so here, cheating Peggy, if Peggy is a cheater, ...25% chance to succeed, 1/4. Third time, 1/8. Fourth time, 1/16. So we're raising it to the powers of 2. So 50th time, there is no chance. It's too close to 0. So do it 100 times and Victor is completely convinced that Peggy knows. And creating 100 graphs that are isomorphic to G1 is trivial. So Peggy always chooses G1, let's say. But if she always chooses G1, Victor may know this and only ask for... She'll get caught the first time if she doesn't know the answer. So she should randomly choose one graph, do another one isomorphic, figure out, since G1 and G2 are isomorphic, that's the claim. If they are not, Peggy cannot prove it. If they are and Peggy knows the connection, then she can create graphs from any which one, they'll be all the same graph. So that convinces Victor. That's an interactive zero-knowledge proof of graph isomorphism. Now, can we do it for other things? Like, satisfiability or traveling salesman or whatever these problems are. For each of those problems, you'll have to come up with a technique of how to do it. And so in theory, that's the story. Now, if the problem is linear time to solve, then not only Peggy, even Victor can work it out. Now, if I know what is the, that these two graphs are isomorphic, I can prove it. Creating two graphs that are isomorphic is trivial. Proving two graphs are isomorphic is very difficult. Verifying two graphs are isomorphic, given the mapping, trivial. So this is like a puzzle. There is a solution to this puzzle. Finding the solution is hard. Given the solution, it's easy to verify. But I don't want to give you the solution. I want to show that I know the solution. I will not give it to you. Okay? So our first example of graph isomorphism, we showed that it's interactive. Thank you. Now, this says it's interactive. That means Peggy discloses something, and Victor chooses, gives a challenge, then Peggy solves it, and then we repeat. So there are two negatives to it. One is it needs to be interactive, and the second is that it has to be done serially. Now, in normal proving, you just prove. It's not interactive. You just prove it and I verify it. And it's done in one step. So if we look at, can we make modifications to this, where let's start with, I don't want it to be serial, I want it to be parallel. That is, if I have enough compute power, can I just parallelly generate the proofs instead of going one step at a time? And this is trivial to do. How would you parallelize it without going one step at a time? That's correct. So once Victor gives Peggy gives all the graphs or all the pseudo solutions or whatever it is for the problem, Victor asks for, produces a challenge, each bit corresponding to one of these graphs, and Peggy can now do it in parallel. But it's still interactive. That is, Peggy gives Victor something, Victor comes up with a challenge, Peggy provides the solution. Non-interactive will be there is no Victor. Okay? There is no Victor. Peggy just creates a whole proof, writes it down, and anybody who looks at it will go, yeah, this is a proof. That's not hard either. How would you do that? Non-interactive zero-knowledge proof. Let's take the same problem, graph isomorphism. There is no Victor. Any ideas? Yeah. Peggy already knows the answers. Why? Peggy can cheat. Peggy does not know G1 to G2. She picks G2 to this and picks a challenge going that way, she can fabricate the whole proof. So, yeah. So without knowing the correlation, Peggy can show you that I've got this other graph that's now goes with G1, yet another graph that goes with G2, yet another graph that goes with G1. She can cheat. Okay. Here's the cheating. Okay, let me see if I can explain. So I'm saying Peggy is cheating. G1 and G2 may or may not be isomorphic. She doesn't know whether it is. She's claiming. To do the proof, she creates G prime from G1 and proves G prime isomorphic to G1. G prime from G2 and proves G prime. In the previous case, in the parallel case, Victor generated a challenge vector. And before Victor generated a challenge vector, Peggy had to generate all these. After Peggy generated all this, so Peggy doesn't know what's going to be challenge vector. She has to generate, and once given the challenge vector, she has to prove all these G prime is G1 and G prime prime is G2, etc. So since she does not know the challenge vector, she cannot play games with it. Now that there's no victor, she chooses a challenge vector. And then it's easy to create the proofs. If the challenge vector is 0, you create G prime from G1 and then prove G prime is equal to G1. Trivial. So non-interactive by letting Peggy choose the challenge vector is useless. That doesn't work. Peggy can cheat. So how do you make it work so that Peggy cannot cheat?
Peggy can generate this challenge vector through some random function.
Yes, and what is that function?
She can select a seed and then generate a...
And what if she doesn't do that? How would you know she didn't do that? Yes, what you're saying is that...
She can give out the seed.
She can give out the seed. She will first generate this challenge vector and then construct the solution. So,
huh? I mean, give out every possible vector when that is possible.
Every possible vector, 100-bit vector, we don't have trillions of years. But whatever is the vector, Peggy will create the G's to correspond to the vector. And she can always prove any vector to be. So, why couldn't she do that with Victor's vector? Yes, but couldn't she look at that and then create the G primes?
She has to first create
the G primes. Now that's the thing. The vector has to be created after G primes have been created. And there is a trivial way of doing that. Huh? Timestamp. I can lie. Yes, you're getting closer.
It's a hash.
I mean, okay, hashes are just crazy simple and effective things. So, but remember, there's no victor. Peggy can do any amount of cheating. Peggy. Let's say we are only doing 3. Okay? So this thing that Peggy has written down is all adjacency matrices. So all the adjacency matrices, you concatenate them. It'll be a bunch of zeros and ones. Doesn't matter, there's a format to it, but so what Peggy is told to do, write down all of these, hash it. And hash will be 128-bit hash, let's say. Now you've got a challenge vector. Now provide the solutions. Peggy goes, I think I'll cheat. How? Peggy has to do this first before she gets a challenge vector. If she doesn't, she creates a challenge vector, then she wouldn't be able to back calculate. And moment you write that down, whatever, you can choose to say, this one's not working, let me try another one. I'll get a different challenge vector. But you can never make the challenge vector fall exactly on the parts that you fabricated. You have no control over this challenge vector. So you replace Victor with just a hash function. Does that make any kind of sense? The moment all the graphs are written down, a challenge vector appears through a deterministic, well-known hash function. And if you don't like the challenge vector, you cannot fix the input so that the challenge vector is correct. Okay, so now that Peggy provides I'm claiming that once Peggy writes down this, Peggy writes down the challenge vector, which I can calculate also. As a verifier, I will see that does the hash function match that? Do these graphs all look like proper graphs? And other solutions, I'm going to check for each solution. I'm going to see whether the mappings are correct. And all Peggy has done is written all of this out into a file. And then anybody can come in and say, hey, look at this proof. Peggy knows the connection between G1 and G2. But she didn't tell us what's the connection. It's zero knowledge. It's non-interactive. And it's one time generated by Peggy without input from Victor. And that's kind of a zero knowledge proof of graph isomorphism, non-interactive. And you can transform any interactive proof on this system to a non-interactive proof or a parallel proof, which is not that interesting. So that's pretty much it on zero-knowledge proofs. Now, how do you apply it? The closest to application is this is a replacement for a challenge response. If you didn't know challenge response systems, you could use a zero knowledge proof of authentication. getting bad. So the algorithm is called Fish Fiat Shamir, proof of authentication, proof of identity. We take the number set a modulus n p times q. If the modulus is n is equal to p times q, s, any number less than n, you can compute the square of that. Oh, I don't even have to make that claim. Given a square, if I give you this, you cannot compute the square root. We've been over that in oblivious transfer. There are four quadratic residues, there's four square roots, but you can't get any of them. Unless if you know P and Q, then you can. Okay? By S squared, I mean S squared mod n. So Alice creates her identity. It's just like a key pair. In a key pair, you have create your own public and private keys and tell everybody this is my public key and I can prove I know my private key by just one challenge response. Here, one challenge response is not good enough. S is private, P and Q are private. And P and Q are private, but really you don't have to throw it away. It's not needed anymore. P and Q, you created n out of P and Q. You publicly stated what your modulus is. Throw away P and Q. We don't need it. You pick a random number less than n. N is a very large random number, product of large primes. And compute your own public key, which is S squared. And disclose S squared. Okay? Now these are not public-private keys in the sense of encryption, but public-private identities. And let's call it Peggy. So Peggy tells Victor, here's my public identity, S squared. It could be an S squared, Peggy can cheat, whatever, but Peggy claims that I know the square root of this number. There's no reason to cheat. Take a number, square it, disclose the square, and claim that you know the square root. You did. Now, there is man in the middle possible and all that, so it's boiling down to the same thing, but she uses that public key, and that public key is registered as Peggy's public key, and nobody knows the square root of that, so that secret is safe with Peggy. Victor, now she has to prove that she knows the square root. Easy, just disclose the square root. Oh, no, I'm not going to disclose the square root. I'm going to prove that I know my square root. Okay? So obviously there is a way of doing that, otherwise we wouldn't have this discussion. This is a little confusing, but we'll spend that. So Peggy computes R squared and sends it to Victor. Peggy may choose to compute R squared or may choose to just send out a random number. But it's probably in her best interest to compute R squared. We'll have to see what goes on. If Victor says zero, then Peggy has to disclose R. Okay? If Victor says 1, Peggy has to disclose SR. Now, if Peggy generates a square of a random number, why would you even ask for question 0? Coming to that later. How would you verify that Peggy answered question 0 correctly? Square and check. So Peggy says R, Victor just takes the square of this number, and that should be equal to that. But Victor says 1. How do you verify? Peggy's supposed to send you SR. Did she send you SR? You have R squared and you have S squared, yeah. Once you compute S squared and R squared, you know what's R squared, you know what's S squared. Is this number the same as the multiplication of S squared and R squared? If the answer is yes, Peggy answered correctly. Okay, so these answers can be verified. Does this really prove Peggy knows S? So two things. Does it really prove that Peggy knows S is one question? Why would Victor even provide a zero question? Because if Peggy is giving you, Peggy can answer zero without knowing S. Okay, second one is harder. Does this prove, if I keep doing this 100 times, does it prove that Peggy knows S? Because if Peggy knows S, then the identity problem is authenticated. Is that true? Well, you know Peggy's public key. She has proven that she knows the square root of that public key. Hence, she knows S, hence that's Peggy. So what makes it provable that if Peggy can do this, she knows S? Yes.
So when Bob computes, sorry, Victor computes S square, R square, he already knows what R square.
And he knows S squared. So when he computes that, he goes, okay, so you know the square root of R, which you sent me, and you need the square root of S to compute this. So I, eventually, because I'm asking you both questions, and you're answering correctly, you must know S. But then Victor goes, why am I asking the second question, first question? If I just ask this question once, Peggy will need us to compute that. So let's fix this protocol by saying, Victor, you don't have to do this interactive thing. Just do the second part that you get R squared, then you ask for SR. And you verify. The reason why you shouldn't do that is because Peggy can cheat. Okay? So Victor is only going to ask the second question. So Peggy goes, okay, I can play your game. I am generating an R, I am squaring it, and instead of sending you R squared, I send you R squared divided by S squared. Peggy knows S squared. She may not know S. She's an imposter who found somebody's public key and is trying to prove. So Peggy sends R squared divided by S squared, and Victor thinks this is R squared. Peggy now sends R. This quantity is the same as this squared times S squared. So what is Victor's algorithm? When he gets SR, he takes the square of that. No, he takes R squared, which is this guy, and he takes S squared, and this value must be equal to Victor's R squared and S squared. And this value is equal to Victor's. Victor thinks X is R. So R squared times S squared is the second, is the value Peggy sends. So Peggy can cheat. But if she does this cheating, she cannot provide the square root of X if Victor says zero. So So this cheating doesn't work if Victor chooses both values. So that's why he has to choose both values, 0 and 1, even though 0 sounds to be useless. It'll stop Peggy from doing this. Okay? Oh, maybe it is. SR? Yeah, y square. Thank you. SX squared, X squared, S squared, all the same thing. No, these are all numbers. You can't figure out anything. Okay, let's do it again. Now I'm getting confused. So I have two ways of doing this. One is the one that I presented, and in that case, anybody who's cheating can do the first one. Cheater cannot do the second one. This is a modified version where cheater cannot do the first one, cheater can do the second one. But in both cases, Victor cannot figure out whether you're using that algorithm or this algorithm. Because what he is getting is a number. In that case, it's getting S, the number R. In this case, he's getting the number S divided by R. I'm sorry. In that case, he's getting R squared. In the second case, he's getting S squared divided by R squared. How does he know which number he's getting? He doesn't. It's a number. So we don't know what Peggy is up to. But if Peggy knows Victor is going to ask 0, she uses that one. If Peggy knows Victor is going to ask 1, she can use this one. Both cases, she does not need to know what the secret is. However, since she doesn't know what Victor is going to ask, she won't be able to succeed in both cases. Because if she knew that Victor is only going to stay in this model, then she can always give out S squared divided by R squared and cheat Victor. Okay, I'm done with zero knowledge proofs, unless if you have questions. Okay, now I have 8 minutes left. I won't get into anything, but I'm going to just give you some random topics. Say I want to take a survey of people and ask them an embarrassing question that most people don't want to answer. Or rather, some people are fine, some people are not fine. I'm going to go and ask everybody, do you cheat on taxes? And if you don't, you'll say, no, I don't cheat on taxes. If you do, what will you answer? Oh, no. That's correct. Why would you say? So I want you to answer correctly. You will answer correctly only if you're guaranteed that from your answer, I cannot figure out whether you're a cheater or not. How can I do that? Okay, so I'm asking the correct question directly, and you are told, everybody does this, flip a coin, if it's heads, answer it correctly, if it's tails, answer the opposite. So in a group of non-cheaters, half the people will say, yeah, I cheat, right? So these answers are irrelevant. Just because you said you cheat doesn't make you a cheater. You could be just following the protocol correctly. And in a group of cheaters, half of them will say no, and half of them will say yes. But in a group of cheaters and non-cheaters, I can figure out how many people statistically cheat. Because if all of them are cheaters, I would get 50% non-cheater. If all of them are non-cheaters, this work? If all of them are non-cheaters, half of them will say yes. If all of them are cheaters, okay. If all of them are cheaters, they will all say yes. If all of them are non-cheaters, half of them will say yes. So 0% cheaters will raise to 50% yeses, 100% cheaters, 100% yeses, so you've scaled it. So if you get 75%, you know 50% are cheating. But it doesn't disclose whether you're a cheater or not. Just because you said yes doesn't mean anything. You've been told to say yes. Right? This is a correct way to do anonymous surveys of embarrassing questions. Anything, any flaw here? Okay, one other simple topic. So an accumulator is something that adds. But you, one-way accumulator is you cannot subtract. So can I say that here's an accumulator. If I add x to it, I get the second value. But if I using plus as my operator, then from these two values, I can subtract and calculate x. I want a one-way accumulator. That is, if I add the number 10 to this accumulator, it'll become a different number. But that number and the original number cannot be subtracted to get 10. So it only goes forward, does not go back. And this has been shown to be useful in group identities and things like that. So there are some bizarre hash functions which can do this. And you need a hash function that does this. Hash of x with an older value will the same thing of hash of y with this value. And that way, replace the plus with a hash function that takes x and some value and computes the second value. And that's a one-way accumulator. So another crypto tool, if constructed from certain types of hash functions that could be useful in preserving the secrecy of X. I get a number, I add my private number to it, I give it back to you, you don't know what my private number is. So a group identity is everybody adding their private nonsense to a number, but the final output represents the group. It can be constructed again and again if everybody participates, but you will not know anybody's identity. Okay, we're done. Any questions? What do we have next? Oh, we have next, we will talk about OTR, which is plausible deniability and perfect forward security. You've had a lecture on that, but I'm going to go much deeper into it.